I was like, they told me I got life. This is where I'm going to die. Okay, I'm watching everybody else die. What makes me different? Yeah, I've lost hope before.
That's the voice of Michelle Pearson. I've lost hope before, she says. Michelle was convicted of first-degree murder in 1983 after a gun she was holding, according to her, accidentally fired during a robbery. She was 17 years old at the time of the crime, and after turning herself in, Pearson was sentenced as a juvenile to life in prison without parole. A lot of people, including Michelle's brother Alan, believed that that life sentence was too harh.
I mean, you got police officers that's done killed young guys and they get 2 years in jail or probation, or, you know, you got other guys that kill other guys or other women that kill guys, you know, vice versa, and they don't get nowhere near the time that my sister has. So what makes my sister that much of a monster compared to these other people?
Michelle is in her 50s now, but a pair of recent Supreme Court cases have given new hope to inmates like Michelle Pearson. In 2012, in the case Miller versus Alabama, the court ruled that the mandatory sentencing of juveniles to life without parole was unconstitutional. And then last year, in Montgomery versus Louisiana, the court decided that Miller needed to be applied retroactively. And that meant that thousands of juvenile lifers like Michelle Pearson had their sentences vacated. But in some states, that process is moving slowly. And despite the Supreme Court's orders, hundreds of inmates convicted as juveniles still have their life sentences and no clear idea of when they could be released. Joining me now is Danielle Wolf. She's a reporter for The Nation, and she spent the last year profiling some of the roughly 50 women who were sentenced to life as juveniles. Danielle, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with Michelle Pearson, because she was scheduled to have her resentencing hearing yesterday. Is that right? Did it go off?
It did.
How did it go?
It didn't go so well for her. She wound up being resentenced to 38 years plus an additional 2, which means she'll have to serve at least 6.5 more years before she could even be considered for parole.
What was the rationale for 6 more years that she would have to serve for a crime that she was involved in at 17?
And this is the strange part. The judge actually used the phrase pure punishment. From what I understand it, the hearing didn't actually take into account any of the factors that should be taken into account according to Miller and Montgomery.
What do judges consider now that the Supreme Court has ruled that this type of sentence that you got back in the 80s in this case is unconstitutional? How does the judge consider that? What do they consider when they decide whether the 32 years you've served is enough or not? Now you're in your 50s.
They're supposed to consider a variety of factors that coincide with the Miller and Montgomery rulings. So some of those factors include your immaturity at the time of the crime, your upbringing, you know, trauma related to your upbringing, poverty, any extenuating circumstances that may have occurred during the crime, and whether or not you showed you've changed, you've matured, basically, whether or not you've grown up and you've proven that you're a responsible citizen, you've owned your crime, and you can be trusted to be back in society, essentially. Interpreting all that is a very subjective and difficult task for many judges, even if Montgomery and Miller resonates with them, if they're sympathetic to the person who's coming up before them.
I want to talk about Michelle Pearson a little bit. Let's hear from her talking about what her life was like before she got locked up.
I would go to stores and beg. I've taken food to feed them because I didn't want them hungry, and we didn't have a mother. We didn't have a father. You know, I was a kid raising kids that weren't mine.
Michelle, they're talking about begging at the store to take care of children in her family. You've been covering the stories of women situated like this, and there aren't many, but there are roughly 50. How do their stories differ from the many hundreds, thousands of men who were locked up when they were juveniles?
I think there are probably a lot of similarities, but the thing that differs, there are a couple of things. Women were more likely to be girls at the time, were more likely to have been caretakers of siblings or other relatives prior to committing their crime. They're more likely to experience sexual abuse or trauma. They're more likely to be abused again while they're in prison, so re-traumatized by male guards. There's been quite a few cases of the women I've spoken with who have suffered sexual abuse by guards after being incarcerated. And, you know, they have kids. So they either are leaving kids behind, many of them, or they, like in Michelle's case, she was raped by a guard and became pregnant and subsequently had to give the baby up. Or, you know, they're in prison for all of their viable childbearing years.
What else has Michelle told you about what her life was like leading up to the crime that she was involved in when she was a kid?
She experienced a lot of trauma when she was growing up. She had just a really, really horrific kind of childhood. Her mother died of cancer when Michelle was 11. Her stepfather was a heroin addict and sexually abused Michelle. She was sexually assaulted in various foster homes where she went. She ran away and she came back to help her brother and sister, essentially, because she heard they were in trouble, and wound up hooking up with an abusive man, and eventually this led to her crime.
Let's step back from this case. Where did the idea of sentencing juveniles to life without parole come from? And this was the 80s and the 90s. What was going on then? How did this idea come into fashion?
There was this mythology of the teenage super predator, that it was a term that sociologists dubbed as a response to spikes like high crime waves and juvenile crime waves. And that led to, or that was partially what was responsible to, for a wave of judges to push for much harsher sentences for juveniles.
And so now we're in the era of criminal justice reform, right? Attitudes largely have changed. But as we said, some states are just going really, really slowly here. What happens to the convict, to the person convicted as a juvenile who sits and waits? Do they have any idea of how much longer it is before they even get a hearing?
Sometimes yes and sometimes no. The really sad thing about this is these are a group of people who were basically told from the time they were very young, you're going to die in prison. That's it. You have no chance. We're not going to rehabilitate you. You have no chance. You're never getting out. Now in 2012 and then again in 2016, they're told you have hope. There's light at the end of the tunnel. You're getting out. And in 2016, it was really reinforced for people. They had a lot of hope then. And then this whole year and a half has been like an emotional roller coaster for most of them. I mean, many of us get freaked out when we are in between jobs or in between houses or relationships, and there's that kind of uncertainty in our lives. These are people that are having their fates decided for them. They're being told either you're going to die here in prison or you're going home, and they've been seesawing between that since this all started. So it's really hard on them.
More than 1,000 inmates across the country convicted for crimes as juveniles and sentenced to life without parole, awaiting their fate after the Supreme Court has ruled that their sentences are unconstitutional. Danielle Wolf has been telling some of their stories for The Nation. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.